I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my chance that I could make those people dance and maybe they'd be happy for a while. But February made me shiver with every paper I'd deliver. Bad news on the doorstep. I couldn't take one more step. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride. But something touched me deep inside the day the music died. So bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die.
Most of us by now, and I think it's widely accepted, that Don McLean's song that you just heard the beginning to refers to Buddy Holly. I don't know if there's an argument about that, though McLean has played very coy over the years about all the symbolism in that one song. But anyway, we have with us Benny of Benny and the International Texans. You would know Benny from a song he did called Something's Going On, which was the second of three theme songs I've used, the first being Candy Dulfer's Lily Was Here, and a latter one right now called Color TV by Angiovia. But a lot of people thought that Benny and all those recorded instruments were the Smithereens. A lot of people thought that, but it was Benny, and he's with us now. We're going to talk about his exposure to the recording scene out of Clovis, New Mexico, which many of you folks may not know anything about, but that's where Buddy Holly got his start. And Benny has lived in the panhandle of Texas for quite some time. Holly was a Lubbock boy that recorded in Clovis, and so did Benny. So we're going to hear about what it was like to be, I guess you could say, in one of the high holy shrines of recording. And Benny's with us right now. And thanks a lot. I know you're busy, understand it, busy time of year, but thanks for coming on.
Hey, Viz. Thanks for having me.
Now, just tell us, I mean, I'm assuming, just as I wanted to be a major leaguer, did you also, when you were growing up, at somewhere along the line, say, you know what, I think maybe I could cut this as a recording artist or part of a band or something like that? What was going through you when you first picked up the guitar and learned to play? What was the objective?
Well, actually, it was the drums that I took up when I was 4 years old when I
okay.
got hooked. I saw a guy playing a jazz drum set on TV and said, I want one of those. And I pestered my poor grandmother till she broke down and bought me a set. And I was about four when the Beatles were on TV and that whole scene was happening and just kind of got bit by the bug and all along was always into it. And probably about the time I was getting through junior high, going into high school, it was something, you know, really wanted to do, give it a try. So
when did you pick up the guitar, and did you ever learn to read and write music?
Well, I picked up the guitar probably when I was 19 and I started playing just because I wanted to learn to write songs. And to do that, had to have a vehicle to play chords against, and learned to play guitar, taught myself, and just just because it was something I wanted to do. I just write songs was something I really wanted to try.
Yeah, I guess it would be that for the most part, we'll just talk about popular recording artists usually use the piano or the guitar, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Then I found out, you know, you didn't have to know how to read and write music. You know, I'd taken piano lessons when I was in grade school. Really hated it. You know, it didn't go along with being on the baseball team and all the guys giving you heck about taking piano lessons, but I did it. But I never really learned to read music too well, and then I learned most songwriters just wrote songs by ear, all the rock and roll guys. They didn't know how to read music, so cool, yeah, I can do that.
Well, listen, if you think back, I mean, remember what Chuck Berry wrote and sang? Johnny B. Goode never learned to read or write what? Too well, but he could play a guitar just like a ring and a bell, so...
That's right.
Yeah, and then you hear about McCartney didn't either, so you wonder, but... now, 1918, a lot would say that's kind of late to pick up the guitar and do something with it, but you did. Was your first foray into performing a solo or part of a group?
It was part of a band. I went to college 1 year right out of high school, and then that summer I met some guys at a local town nearby, and they had a band, and they needed a drummer. So I played with them that summer, and then a couple of them went to college, but there were two brothers in the band, and they asked me if I wanted to play in the band, and they were going to see what they could do, you know, play around. So I said, sure, that's what I wanted to do. So it took some convincing from my family, you know, not to go back to college, but they let me give it a try. So I played drums in the band, and that's about the time I picked up guitar when I was in the band and just started learning on my own.
How long from that time was it that, and tell us what began also this whole bit about actually going over to record in Clovis, Norman Petty's place where Buddy Holly had once been.
Okay, probably, we started playing, and this was 78, the summer of 78 when our band started playing. And we went down and played around Houston area and came back. And I think when we came back around Christmas time that year, the oldest brother had recorded down at Norman's when he was a teenager. And I think Norman had sold his single, but he was only 14 or so at the time, and his mom wouldn't let him do it. So now he called him, and we set something up for in the springtime, and we went down there probably March of 79. So that's when we made the trek to Clovis.
All right, so was this in back of recording that particular song, or were there other things you did there? How long or how many times did you actually get to go over there?
Oh, we went several times, probably four or five times. And first time we went over, you know, he just wanted to hear us. And Norman had a thing where he, like most studios, you pay by the hour. Well, he had this thing, you just paid by the song, where there was no pressure, you know, to rush through and get things done. You could take all the time you wanted. So we went down there, went to his place, and his recording studio, at the time, he had bought this old theater in downtown Clovis, a movie theater, and he had gutted the place, put new seats, you know, had a stage with a grand piano, and up in the projection, where the projection booth was his control room, where he did all his monitoring, and so it was a really cool place. You know, we were in awe.
Where did the musicians play on the stage?
Well, he set up my drums down on the stage, and so I played down there. And if he wanted a big sound out of the drums, he would open the curtains, and it would reverberate in there. And along the sides of the theater in there, he had these little thin chains all the way down, which made it like real acoustical, real reverberant.
In other words, we got the difference here between sound absorbing and sound kind of reflecting, right. Whereas drapes would deaden the sound and give you more of a subdued tone. If he wanted to make your drums hot, he pulled back the curtains, right?
Right. And, he'd close them if he wanted an intimate sound.
And what about, you're saying chains. Are these, I'm trying to visualize, are these like what, 20 links of metal that are just dangling kind of vertically?
Now, think a real fine chain, really thin, and just right up next to each other. So I don't know how many thousands of strings of chain were hanging from the ceiling down to the floor, all the way around the sides of the theater.
Now, if you had, say, three guitars, you said there was a baby grand on the stage, right?
Right.
Would you have the other people playing guitars with boom mics coming down?
Well, there were, the bass guitar would go straight into the board, just a direct thing. So the bass player would just play in the control room with Norman. And then off to the side of the control room was a little room with a big glass wall, and the guitar player would go in there. And usually that's what we did to start, bass, drums, and one guitar, just to lay the initial track. And then if we needed anything else, a piano or other guitars or a lead guitar, we would overdub that later. And then the vocals at the end.
You would track vocals after?
Right.
All right, so in those days, what were you doing? Were you doing 8 tracks?
No, he had a 24-track. And this was 79, so 24
okay,
tracks.
Okay, right.
Pretty common.
All right, but what's interesting is, but the musicians are kind of removed from each other in proximity. There is no proximity, really.
No, but we rehearsed like the Dickens, so we knew those songs backwards and forwards by the time we got there.
Were you wearing headphones?
Yeah. That's the only way I could hear.
I would think,
on stage.
Yeah. Right. So that was kind of an interesting setup, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And that theater was just so dang cool. It just lent this feel of majesty to the place. And I think I read that he bought that place because he wanted to record, symphonies and strings and things in there. I don't know if he ever did, but I think that's why he bought it.
Norman Petty was a visionary, obviously, and of course, he is a lightning rod to this day as for criticisms and also, both positive and negative comments.
Right.
Was that a Clovis movie theater, though? Was that the building's origins?
I think it was. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was a movie theater. It wasn't a huge theater.
Right.
But it was. It was a good-sized theater.
Yeah, I would, when you really mention it, in the old days, now, of course, we've got all these Cineplexes and stuff like that, but if we can roll it back to the 70s, as you said, and even earlier than that, when Holly was there, I assume, in the 50s, that would actually make, and I used to wonder about that when I would go to the old Park Lane Theater in Jersey. You take a look around and you say to yourself, they could hold other things here, but it's just now strictly movies, but everything was there to have a concert or something, and just never seemed to happen. So when you mention it, and you said there was a projectionist booth, which Petty used as a control room, was there a balcony there as well? Do you remember?
Yeah, there was a place, because you would walk in like you were walking into a movie theater, and then you would turn to your left, and then turn to go up, and there was a stairway going up, and there were some seats on the way, just a few on the way up. And then up you went into the control room right there. And the control room was sectioned off with a big glass wall that looked over into the theater.
Now, Holly had been there, is that correct? He had been there, probably 20 years before you got there, correct?
Well, no, he didn't record at the theater. I think Norman bought this in the late 60s or early 70s. So the place where Buddy Holly recorded, Norman still had it, but we didn't go over there. I went afterwards, but since they've restored it as a museum there in Clovis.
All right, I can go take a look for this. I don't know if it's necessary, but are we referring to what, like, he named the studio kind of like an anagram for himself and his wife's name, like Norvac or something like that?
Oh, Norvajack. I think that was their publishing company.
Oh, that was a publishing company. All right.
Yeah, and that's out in the front of the old, the side building of the office building of the old recording studio. And then there's a courtyard in between, and then off to the left is a recording studio. And I think it's got a sign, Norman Petty Recording.
Apparently he did get quite busy after Buddy Holly. Now, I want to bring you back to what you had said about what his business approach was, that he charged people per song. Now, this, as the story goes, and I think you're going to tell us whether that's fact or fiction, because you conversed with Petty also, didn't you?
Yes, right.
All right, the story goes was that if a band or a performer did not have the money, they would record it, and he would say, listen, if the thing makes it, we'll split the profits. If it doesn't, I'll absorb the loss. True or false?
Right, that's true, and that's what he did with us. I mean, the first time we went, we took a handful of songs. He recorded two of them, and we paid for those. But then he was interested in us. He thought we were good. And so from then on, we didn't pay for recording. And I don't, you know, at the time, I wasn't writing the songs for the band. And I know with Buddy Holly, he put his name on most of the songs, whether he wrote any or not on the song. And then I know he did help with writing on a few, and he would change a few things here and there. But I also know there were some he didn't write anything on that he did put his name on. So that was kind of the way they worked it in the 50s. But I don't know if that was our arrangement with the brother that wrote the songs at the time.
You know, some stories make him seem like a Shylock. You hear a lot of those stories as you go on in the early years of rock and roll. When really performers and also their producers, nobody really knew what they had. I mean, Sun didn't know what they had with Elvis until, you know, it finally happened. Same with Jerry Lee Lewis. Now, as Sun had Elvis, Decca had Buddy Holly. And you also, Richie Valens apparently had problems trying to get certain monies, and his family did after the death. And, of course, ironically, it was Valens that was with Holly, two of the three people that were in that plane crash in February of 1959, the other being J.P. Big Bopper Richardson. So there was this, I mean, the Valens situation seemed extremely acrimonious with their, you know, manager slash producer. Some say that Holly would not have had to do that, you know, one city a night tour in the winter had he been able to free up some money from Petty. And I guess there's a thought that, so then what are we saying? By extension, Petty's responsible for Buddy's death. I don't think that's fair entirely. But for more, Benny, what I'm going to ask you is, like, you dealt with the guy, you've heard things, you saw things, but you're also, you know, you went beyond the hand that shook the hand. You know, you dealt with Petty. Just give us your take on what you know with all that you saw firsthand and knew.
Yeah, firsthand, I can say Norman was a really good guy, a really, really nice guy, a soft-spoken guy, but, you know, he knew his business, he knew recording, he knew sound, and he was always great with us. You know, I never got a feeling of him being shady in any way with us, and, you know, he never charged us anything. When we go down there, you know, we'd go for days at a time. 3, 4, 5 days. He had a place, a small little mobile home for the people staying there that recorded to stay there overnight. We would stay there, never charged us anything. You know, he tried to sell our stuff, but, you know, it just wasn't in the cards.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I never got any kind of feeling from him personally that, you know, that he wasn't a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
He came across as a Christian fellow. He, you know, he never paraded it around, but you knew.
When you came to some kind of awareness as a performer, It was through the 70s, correct?
Right.
All right. Now, what's interesting is, I'd say I always liked, I mean, I grew up with rock and roll. All right. Here's one of the situations. My sister was 8 years older than I. So you figure it out. You know, when I'm 7 years old, I'm hearing everybody. And because she was a record buyer and because AM radio was alive and well and competitive in New York City, I mean, it was just a field day for music. And everything was pretty much, you know, 2-3 guitars, maybe a keyboard, maybe, and drums, and that's it. It was simple. It was good. We liked it. That's why they called it rock and roll. Now, when you come to your time of awareness and probably the height of you know, you're practicing and performing and such. There was a time when I guess you were younger, and this is before 79, when music swung also, kind of with the resurgence of FM radio, with heavily synthesized music. You know, and I'm not saying that didn't have a place, but that was a whole era when you had, what, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and you know, Jorica Conan. And the old rock and roll seemed somewhat, at least on a commercial level, to slip back a little bit. Let me ask you, did you notice that out by you, but were you and your closest associates kind of dedicated to the old, frankly, rock and roll?
Well, my taste in music, you know, I really got into music when I was really young, grade school and that era. So I was a big Motown Beatles fan. So that's always kind of driven me, you know. And then we go into the 70s, you know, and you got things like Bread and those really poppy kind of bands, and I wasn't really into that. And then you had the hard rock stuff like Grand Funk. I kind of like Grand Funk and some of those, and oh, like Alice Cooper.
Yeah, and heavy metal started at that time too.
Yeah, but I was always kind of pop oriented, song, really just like a good song. And about the time we were doing the band, you know, disco was in its heyday, and we just hated disco. you know, it was, oh, no. So I kind of went anti-disco. You
right,
know, whenever
right.
Whenever guys, the new waivers, like Elvis Costello, I kind of jumped on that bandwagon mm-hmm. with those guys. So that was around that time. And our band, you know, we were shooting to get on the radio, so we were kind of doing songs kind of more in the pop vein, and when you're young, you know, we kind of disagreed on what kind of songs we should do, but I wasn't writing songs at the time. I was just learning. I was just getting there. So that's kind of, you know, our thing worked out with Norman doing pop tunes. He liked our band, but didn't get a soul, so I went back to college about, oh, it was summer 1980, I think.
It's interesting that you said what you did with regard to see, there's a Freudian for you, with Elvis Costello, because if there was anybody that came on the scene who more evoked the remembrance of Buddy Holly, it was Costello, wasn't it?
Yeah, with the glasses.
Yes.
You know, and, yeah. And just that raw, basic, you know, four-piece band.
Yeah, right, yeah. And that's what I was going to say to you, because it seemed right around the end of the 70s, and for whatever reason, I found myself hanging around Detroit. I actually did clear my throat. There was nothing meant in that, but there was a return. It's as if, and this happens with all music, let's face it. It's as if, okay, you know, the synthesized stuff was nice. Nice and White Satin, that's good. As we said before, you know, Brain Salad Surgery, that's fine too. But it seems like it got back to the old plange and three guitars and the drums. And I think Detroit was one of the places where that return to roots occurred because of the Romantics. And I don't know who else all is out of Detroit. It's escaping me now, but I think of Jay Giles. And of course, I think that's Boston, but there was a return to that. And I missed it. So it was good to embrace. And we saw kind of like the second coming, even Tom Petty, you could say, went back to the basics again, you know, and Seeger.
Yeah. I remember Tom Petty like being one of those saviors at the time when disco was going on, and I saw him on like the Midnight Special or something. I go, mm-hmm. yeah, and I went and bought his album. I said, that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, there's an interesting element too, because although this doesn't necessarily beget going so synthesized, it was Buddy Holly, the first person to incorporate strings in his songs.
Yeah, he did four songs in New York, with a full orchestra, and that was pretty radical. And, I've been going back and reading a little bit since I knew we were going to do this, and just, he was like a total experiment. He was trying different things. He'd come from a country western background, and pop radio, in the mid-50s was a mishmash of all kinds of things, and this, rock and roll and rockabilly was just a fad that was going to die, they said, in a year or two. So, I was listening to a lot of his songs, and there are a few clunkers in there, but I think he was experimenting right. quite a bit and got some real gems in that time, just trying all kinds of things.
And it's hard to believe with all that he put out that essentially he did that kind of in a 2-year span, and he dies at 22. Now, does that tell anybody what kind of, if not genius, what progeny he was?
Yeah. There's an album with all his recordings on there out there. I've been listening to it on Spotify. Yeah, and in 2 years, I guess he went to Nashville in 56, and they turned him down. So he went to Norman's in early 57, and in 57, 58, he did 3 or 4 albums worth of material. That's crazy.
And, the thing is, I had emailed my sister, as I said. Now, let's take a look. In 57, she is 14. And I had asked her, I said, listen, I kind of think you weren't an Elvis Presley type of person. I said, were you into Buddy Holly? And she wrote back and she said, no, I like this stuff. She goes, but for me, it was always Ricky Nelson. But she never liked Presley for whatever reason. And, I don't deny him anything. The guy was just absolutely telegenic. I mean, he was almost, you could say, beautiful. Where Buddy Holly was kind of awkward looking. But, he would have grown into his glasses sooner or later. But Elvis wasn't a songwriter.
No.
And a composer. And Holly was all that rolled up into one.
Yeah, he had a band. They played all their own stuff. He was the lead guitar player. He wrote almost all the songs. They were a unit, and that was what was a big influence on the Beatles and all those guys.
Right. Coming up. Well, there's a story that's out there that when the Beatles came to Ed Sullivan, they said, Buddy played here, right? And he's like, yeah, and Ed talked to him and stuff, and I think he pointed to someone, this is the story, I guess you can even find on Wikipedia or whatever, and he said, that guy right there, held the cue cards for them, for Buddy, and they were like, wow. And of course, and we'll play some cuts throughout this audio if I haven't started already, because I'm going to do a lot of mixing after this is over. But the Beatles saluted Holly, and I'll tell you what, I had no idea. Remember now, what am I? I'm like 14. I remember Buddy Holly, and what I know of Buddy Holly is Peggy Sue, and that'll be today. Okay, that's it. I'm hearing that almost, weekly on all the AM stations. But when I heard Words of Love, I'm like, man, I like that song. It's a little short, but it's quick, and it's pretty. Mm-hmm. And as you would call it, trebly. And I'm like, man, I like that kind of guitar, which, the Byrds also used. There was a little switch to that at that time. And come to find out, Words of Love is written by, guess who? Buddy Holly.
Yeah, and I'd heard, when I was little, I used to read and listen to everything about the Beatles, and I heard them say, Buddy Holly and the Crickets were a big influence. And in my mind, I just thought that it was this big dance band or something, I really didn't understand who Buddy Holly was till later on. But what a influence it was to them that they could write their own songs and their own band could do that. Spurred them on to try what they did.
Do you have any war stories that Petty may have shared with you about Buddy, or did that not happen?
He didn't talk a lot about Buddy, but one time, one of our guys was sitting down on the on the stage playing the grand piano, just working out a song. And Norman walked up behind him and said, M-I-C, M-O-S, kind of, you know, saying it like that. We go, what was that? He said, Buddy Holly used to come up behind him whenever, you know, Norman was playing the piano and say that, you know, like Mickey Mouse, but he would misspell it just for fun. And then another cool thing, I was down there on the stage one day, and there was this little, I would have described it as a little bitty harpsichord kind of piano. And I was just noodling around on it. And Norman came up and said, you know, we recorded that on a Buddy Holly song. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, that was on Every Day.
Okay.
And I never heard Every Day at that time, but that was a little, it's called a Celeste. They used that on that song.
And let me just say in that vein, because I've asked you this, and I just referred to it now, and Lady Viz plays the guitar, and I've talked to her about it too, you know, and that is, there was this kind of, I don't know, I just called it like, it sounded like high string guitars that, as I mentioned before, the Byrds would use. McGuinn had, in fact, it sounds a lot like when people have 12-string guitars as well. And I mean, I just happen to like it, but I don't know how they achieved that. Like you called it trebly, and that's also what was in the Beatles' version of "Words of Love," and that's also, as you had just mentioned now, that was in "Every Day." I mean, I just happen to like that, and I saw there was a resurgence of that, or at least a continuation, making it more popular in the early to mid '60s. And the Beatles ran with that, and so did the Byrds and some others. And you kind of know with my mashed up way I'm explaining this what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I think we talked about this another time that, you know, the Beatles were in trying to do something different or be the first or the best, and on those guitar sounds in those days, they were trying to get the most trebly sounding guitar right in a song.
Thank you.
close and tell me how you feel. Tell me love is real. Mm-hmm. Words of love you whisper soft and true. Darling, I love you.
Yeah, and I think Words of Love was really emblematic of that. And then you take other Buddy Holly songs, which people will hear right now, and then they take it another way, showing not that they did a different treatment, but I think it showed the versatility of Holly because, like, for instance, Ronstadt would take It Doesn't Matter Anymore.
Doesn't matter anymore.
And poor, pitiful me, or I don't know. That could be Ziva.
It's So Easy she did.
Yeah, that's it. It's So Easy, and we'll have that also. So that was more, I think, an extension. And that was country rock years, but that's the rockabilly side of Buddy Holly, too, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah. Listening to his old recordings, it's kind of funny how he went from this really country band, and then they kind of started doing a few of the Elvis songs and I think a Little Richard tune here and there, how he progressed and then got his own rockabilly kind of sound going, you know, with That'll Be the Day and, you know, It's So Easy.
Mm-hmm. Not Fade Away. Now, here's what I got to ask you. Not Fade Away is a great song. Also, Ronnie Hawkins, Who Do You Love, which has been done most recently, I think, as far as a good, as a big hit. And this is also a long time ago, though, by George Thorogood. But doesn't that go back? I mean, who do we really credit with that? Isn't that Bo Diddley?
Yeah, that's Bo Diddley.
Poor Bo Diddley. I mean, how many songs haven't ripped that riff, which is one of the best of all time, you know, rock and roll riffs? I mean, I think it's in the top three, if not the best.
Yeah, and those guys prided themselves, those guys in the 50s, on those riffs. I remember I was at some studio, and there was this black guy, and this was probably the early 80s, and this guy came in there, and then people were talking to him, and he was talking to a bunch of us, and he said, you know that riff, doom, 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 doom. Yeah. He said, I came up with that. That's my riff. Oh, cool.
I just have to laugh because, long story short, okay, Lady Viz and I got married in our house. And we had a couple of people over, and one guy was playing the acoustic guitar, and she came down the steps, and that was the procession. But before he got into it, I knew he was going to do it. I mean, he did it tastefully, and he did it early. You know, he starts strumming easy, and you can hear it coming down the steps, and he starts going into...
I'm gonna love you night and day.
you've recorded a bunch of music. You've said that you kind of like to go back to the basics, which has, you know, no problem here. And you don't have to say yes because it's that kind of interview. But, I mean, was there anything Holly-esque about what you did?
Yeah, there's probably been some songs that kind of evoke the... I try to get back to some youthful emotions, you know, and then I did every once in a while I'll try to do a real basic song.
Your door left to Lovesick Scrawl, but you don't live there anymore. Oh, what happened to our fairy tale? Oh, what happened to our vows? Oh, what happened to our very best intentions? They left with the cat. Falling down. I can't read clearly from your letter. If this broken dream will ever turn around, I tried to call. I waited at your door, but the lovesick scrawl. But you don't live there anymore. Oh, what happened to our fairy tale? Oh, what happened to our vows? Oh, what happened to our very best intentions? They left with the care.
And then going back to Norman, just the whole reason I really got interested in recording was going to Norman's. And even after I quit the band, I went back to see him a couple of times just to talk to him and see if I could learn a few things from him. And the last time I saw him in probably early 1984, Norman had contracted leukemia.
Yeah.
And I called him, and I didn't even realize it. He said, yeah, come on down, I'll talk to you, and meet him at his house where he lived. I went there, and he wasn't feeling good, and he was in a bathrobe, but he talked to me for a couple of hours. But I could tell he wasn't feeling good, and that's the last time I saw him, and then he died that summer. In fact, it was 30 years ago yesterday when Norman died, and I went to his funeral in Clovis.
I mean, yeah, he died at 57. I mean, he was relatively a young man as well.
Right. Yeah, he caught leukemia, and his service, they played some different music, and then right before the last song, right before they started the service, they played True Love Ways, Buddy Holly singing it, and it was like eerie. It was like dead silence in there.
Just you know why. Why you and I will buy and buy no true love ways. Sometimes we'll sigh, sometimes we'll cry.
The day our true love waves
will bring us joy to share with those who really care. Sometimes we'll sigh. Sometimes we'll cry, and you'll know why. Just you and I know true love wins.
I remember watching one documentary a long time ago that interviewed some of, I don't know, was, did Buddy had a brother, did he not? Did he?
He had two brothers.
Okay. And I remember the one brother saying, Buddy said, hey, listen, I got something. He goes, you know, I think you're really going to like it. He goes, let me play it for you. And what he played was Raining in My Heart.
Oh, yeah.
And as the brother recounted what he had done, he said to Buddy, he goes, Buddy, that is beautiful. And by that time, of course, his eyes were all watery. And
the sun is out, the sky is blue. There's not a cloud to spoil the view, but it's raining, raining in my heart. The weatherman says clear today.
Thank you. sky is blue, there's not a cloud to spoil the view, but it's raining, rain in my heart, rain in my heart, rain in my heart.
One other thing, without trivializing this at all, Benny, and that is, did you ever hear anybody that knew him or in and around that New Mexico, Texas area ever chime in on whether or not they liked the movie made on Buddy's life?
No, I never heard anybody talk about it. You know, and how old was I? I was about 18 when that came out, and I went to see it, and it was fun, and that's really where I got my first real introduction to Buddy Holly. You know, that was before we went to Clovis.
That was the movie?
Yeah, that came out in 78, and that was like the summer we were starting the band. And then I got to know Norman, and Norman never, I think we even asked him about it, and he said, well, it just wasn't a very good movie. And so, no, they left Norman out of the movie. It's total fiction of how, Buddy got started and got a recording contract. It's just total fiction. They left Norman totally out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering also, because Gary Busey has run the spectrum of all kinds of behavior. And he's gone through all kinds of things. Although it seemed in that movie that, I mean, he was definitely knuckled down and did, I guess, the best role he could play, being faithful to Holly. I think he kind of did sell it. And, of course...
Yeah, he was great in that movie.
You think so? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I love it.
And, of course...
They kind of got some of the songs wrong and the lyrics are wrong, but as far as his performance of the songs, man, he killed it. And I've got a Gary Busey story for you real quick.
Sure.
When we lived in Hollywood, and this was probably 87, they had the first Guitar Center there in Hollywood, and I'd go down there and just mess around. But one day they had this John Lennon Rickenbacker guitar. I said, man, I got to play this thing. So I pulled it off the wall and plugged it in, and I'm just banging away on it. This guy comes around the corner walking, has two armloads of drumsticks. And I look up, and it's Gary Busey, and he's watching me play this guitar. I'm just backing away. He just looks at me, and he just walks off. Cool.
If you knew Peggy Sue, then you know why I feel blue about Peggy. My Peggy Sue, well, I love you, girl. Yes, I love you, Peggy Sue. Peggy Sue, Peggy Sue, pretty, 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 pretty Peggy Sue. Oh, Peggy. Yes, I love you, girl, and I need you very soon. I love you, Peggy Sue, with a love so rare and true. Oh, Peggy, my Peggy Sue. Well, I love you, girl, and I want you very soon. Look out! Yes, for you, I'll pay you. By the bed soon.
Okay, for someone who doesn't know, it looked like Busey could play the guitar a little.
Yeah, he was a drummer, but I read he learned enough guitar that those guys were actually playing those songs.
Yeah, I guess, and this is true also, and this is what I was always talking about, you know, multitasking, like everybody thinks they can multitask, and I always say, you think you can multitask, sing lead and play lead. Good luck with that. Some people can do it, but I mean, but for most part, I mean, even Lennon, I mean, when you looked at him, he was playing rhythm, which you can at least somewhat compartmentalize your brain, as I cannot do, to play rhythm and sing lead. And that's what I think Busey did. It looked like he was playing just rhythm. Did I say, I meant rhythm, okay?
Yeah, and I watched that movie a few years ago again, and I was watching him, and he doesn't even play lead. When there's a lead, he's just strumming the guitar.
He still continues to do that.
Yeah,
I mean, it's something. I mean, some of these characters who can do this kind of stuff, I have no idea. In fact, when Lennon started playing the harmonica and playing rhythm, I'm like, how do you do that, you know? Also, we had said the Beatles gave Holly a salute with Words of Love. And we're going to play this also within this audio, and that is Lennon himself in 75 to Peggy Sue. And I'll tell you what, you cannot tell that's Lennon for most of the song. I don't know if you remember that rendition whatsoever, but.
Boy, it's been a long time since I've heard it. I know I've listened to it. I'll go listen to it this evening.
Yeah, when this is done. I mean, Lennon, what I liked about him, I mean, he was my favorite of the four. But I also liked the fact, as I got older, also that he connected to the rock and roll stuff beforehand. And of course, he came out with that one album with Stand By Me and stuff, which I think is just excellent. So, you know, that end of the Beatles was him, obviously, with the rock and roll influence. And as you had mentioned before, too, you know, that the Beatles went through like two changes. I mean, one, they came out with very few, if any, original compositions. They did a lot of covers of great R&B songs. I mean, when you look at the Beatles' second album with Roll Over Beethoven and You Really Got a Hold on Me and, you know, Money and all that.
Yeah,
I mean, and it was great stuff, but then they had to get away from it, and eventually you see that breakaway occurring. By the time they hit Beatles 6, which Words of Love was on, this change started to occur. But there was always, you know, that kind of rock and roll element that never left Lennon. And when he went on his own, he brought that back out to quite an extent. Of course, in that movie, the end at the supposed surf ballroom, I mean, what they mocked up. I mean, do you know if they even shot that at the surf ballroom in Clear Lake?
No, I don't know.
I think they might. But anyway, you know, I remember, if you've ever seen the documentary The Last Waltz about the band's final performance out in San Francisco, there was an one of the interviews between Scorsese was with Robbie Robertson. And he said, this is it. He goes, well, you know, what about? He goes, you know, about your lifestyle. He goes, it's a goddamn impossible way of life. No question about it. He said, it's taken some of the great ones. And then he rattled it off, and Buddy was there. I'll tell you this much. This is all I can remember. I remember being, my sister must have been out because I used to sneak into her room because she had the television. You know, so remember, this is what, I'm 7 years old. This is 8 years old. This is 59.
Yeah.
So I surreptitiously sneak into her room with my greatest guerrilla commando tactics. And I'm in there, and it was, I remember, it seemed like a balmy February night, almost like, you know, you get those kind of like January thaws, we used to call them. I mean, even in Vermont, you know, something would come through every so often and just give you a break. And I seem to remember that I was in her room, and I had the windows open, and I had the radio on, and I wasn't sure quite what happened, but somebody died. And I just remember hearing about Holly, Richie Valens, and I got to tell you, probably at that age, like not quite eight yet, I remember the Big Bopper song because that was such a funny song. You know, hello, darling, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's when I heard that the plane crash had taken them. That, of course, that doesn't register much with an eight-year-old or whatever, but I do remember that. And I remember looking out from her window out into the street, which was, you know, dark, and it was probably somewhere along 6 or 7 p.m. in the winter. And I just remember that. And I remember they played some songs, and they went to, and I remember this, the last thing I remember is they went to 409. Whoever sang it, I forget who sang 409. I don't think it was the Beach Boys, but at any rate, and then it's when I just shut down, and that was the end of it. And that's my only, you know, concurrent, contemporary remembrance that something happened that took the lives of the three recording artists.
Yeah, and, you know, rock and roll kind of hit a bad phase right there. You know, Elvis went in the Army, Chuck Berry got arrested, you know, and those three guys died, and another thing or two happened and kind of put a halt to the rockers there. And then, you know, went through a pop phase with Frankie Avalon and Dion and those guys, and it could set it up for the Beatles to come through.
Yep. In fact, Dion and the Belmonts took the bus and didn't.
Yep.
Yeah.
They were on that tour with Buddy Holly.
That's right, they were. I forget who else was there, too. And I think the Crickets, didn't the Crickets actually come out to see him?
No. That was kind of this myth that went on that they were going to get back together. You know, the Crickets had decided to stay in Clovis with Norman, and Norman was going to put a band around them, and he eventually did. But they didn't have any plans to get back together. They might have, but I don't think they had plans at the moment.
Maybe that's at the time when he picked up, help me out here, Waylon Jennings. Yep.
Yeah. Waylon Jennings was a disc jockey in Lubbock, but he taught him the bass and said, you know, we'd come on tour with me on this tour. And his band was supposed to be on that plane. And, you know, those other guys wanted to be on the plane, Richie Valens and the Big Bopper. So Waylon Jennings escaped at that time.
Yeah, and of course, it's like Patsy Cline, too. It was a story about whether a pilot should have tried it. I am assuming he wasn't instrument rated and the visibility, but then some say the visibility was okay, but something was off for him to think, that will never be any kind of, I guess, resolution to that, whether he was thrown off. I mean, but with Patsy Cline, if you remember the story of she was flying with somebody who wasn't instrument rated in fog. And if you have ever ridden in fog, you have no idea. People may not believe this, but when you're up there in fog, you do not know if you're upside down, left, right, or otherwise. I had an experience
Yeah, I've talked to a guy that says, yeah, you don't know if you're going straight up or straight down unless you look at your instrument.
Well, real quick, what happened was we were supposed to set down in Cleveland. And as the guy's setting down, this course is in the wintertime, all of a sudden he pulls back up again, and I'm wondering, what did we just miss, or what just missed us? And I looked across the aisle from right to left, and the woman said, there was a snowplow on the runway on which we were supposed to land. So he pulls back up. Now remember, he circles all the way around to re-enter on that runway.
Mm-hmm.
He did it, and we didn't even know he turned. I thought we were in Canada.
Wow.
And I'm like, holy crap. When you're that sensory deprived, you have no idea. And the story with Patsy's plane was, when it crashed, I believe in Tennessee, they deduced from the way that the trees had been cut by the blades, they were upside down.
Wow.
Oh, man. So anyway, that's the story.
Buddy Holly's crash, they weren't just within viewing distance of the runway.
Exactly.
Where they crashed.
From the one they took off on.
Yeah. They just took off and crashed.
There were 4 or 5 minutes up there. Yeah. And the thing was he disoriented thinking he was needed to pull up. And in fact, he was pushing it down.
Yeah.
And there are, and I will say, look, there's video out there on YouTube. I wouldn't say it's graphic, but it just will fix you where you are because you see three very quiet bodies lying in the snow amongst the wreckage. Big Bopper was the one thrown the furthest, and they thought that maybe he had survived and tried to run, but no, that's not the case. They had no shot whatsoever. And it's obviously it's sad to see, but when you see the bodies at rest like that, I don't know, it just doesn't process, you know, the violence that they had gone through. Yeah, and, you know, I mean, you have two people.
Face down in the field.
Yeah.
You know, they're face down with their coats on.
With the,
wow.
You know, with their raincoat. Yeah, the trench coats.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I know people go take a look. And, I mean, I don't know why not. You know, it's just, I mean, one has been put to music, and I think it's a pretty decent memorial. But, I mean, here you had what? You had one guy 22 and one guy 17. You know, and the age, that kind of gets you. You know, if there's ever a good time, I don't know. But when it's that young, it just seems... It was kind of like a loss. And then his wife turns around and miscarries the baby that she had. And it's like, is there anything good in this at all, you know?
The music.
Take your time. I can't wait for all the love I know will be mine. If you take your time, if you take your time, yeah. Take your time. My baby kisses me.
why do you miss when my baby kisses me? A pretty thing, a pretty thing, a pretty thing.
And that lives on forever. Last thoughts?
Yeah, just looking back, you know, when I went to Norma's to record, I really didn't realize the history. I knew he had recorded Buddy Holly, and I knew a little bit about Buddy Holly. But, you know, when you're young, you're into your time and what you're doing. And I just wish I, you know, could have taken a step back and absorbed it more when I was there. And then after our band quit, I went to talk to Norman a few times. That I started to understand that, and I really appreciated him taking the time to, oh, talk technical things about recording with me and music. So Norman was a great guy. You know, I know there's negative things about him, but just personally, he was, you know, a soft-spoken, quiet person, but he knew his stuff. You know, he was really technically proficient and a musician and a really nice guy.
Not that you have to know this, but do you know the fate of that Clovis Theater and also the studio that Norman had?
Well, I know in the late 80s into the early 90s, his wife opened it up, and a fellow, when I went back to college in the mid-80s, a fellow in Amarillo had a recording studio, and I worked for him. And then I moved to California, me and my wife, and he went to Clovis, and he ran that studio for a while. And then Norman's wife died, I think, in 92, 93, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. And since then, I don't know what's gone on with the theater. Now, the old recording studio has become a museum, and you can take tours. And I actually went when they opened it in the mid-80s. Had to be 85 because we moved late 85. So I've actually seen it. But yeah. I don't know what the state of the theater is.
Kind of reminds me of the Last Picture Show, the movie, you know, out in the high plains of Texas and the end of an era. All right, we'll get you out of here on this part of the interview with, I'm going to ask you what your favorite cover is of a Holly song, what that song is, and the group that does it.
Okay, I'm going to go off board a little bit, and just one that I like is By the Knack, Heartbeat. And Norman actually played us this song. It came out in 78, 79. And Norman would get stacks of albums from record companies.
Yeah, demos, yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep, and he one day we were in there, and he threw on a few songs that were Buddy Holly covers, and he put this one on, and I'd already heard it. I already had the album, and I didn't even realize it was Buddy Holly.
Right.
And I liked the tune, and he said, yeah, this is a Buddy Holly tune. And I said, well, why did they do that? He said, they were fans.
Yep.
And wanted to do it, and I thought, wow, that's cool. So that's my favorite.
All right, we'll get out on that. And I would also mention, too, that with some of the covers that you've heard and will hear yet, those were all fans, and they now span a half century, more than a half century. So that should tell you something about the staying power of Buddy Holly and the genius that we lost when he died at 22. What he put out in 2 years, some people have not put out in a lifetime, so a longer
that's
lifetime.
Great.
All right, Benny, thanks a lot. Good luck with the Benny and the International Texans.
Okay, Biz, I got your number.
Just you know why. Why you and I will by and by no true love wise. Sometimes we'll sigh. Sometimes we'll cry, and we'll know why. Just you and I know true love wise. throughout the day. Our true love ways will bring us joys to share with those who really care. Sometimes we'll sigh, sometimes we'll cry, and we'll know why just you and I know true love ways. Sometimes we'll sigh, sometimes we'll cry, and we'll know why just you and I know true love waits.